Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 26th of April, coming up on the program why Thabo Mbeki has hit the campaign trail, by-election results and what they say about the upcoming poll, and also the rise of the Patriotic Alliance in the Western Cape, why South Africa is missing an SMME trick, Pravin Gordhan under more pressure over the collapsed SAA deal, and addressing the growing student accommodation deficit. And this leads the program today. The parliamentary committee that scrutinized the transaction by the Minister of Public Enterprises, Pravin Gordhan, to sell 51% of SAA to the Takatso Consortium has now recommended that the Minister of Police consider referring the matter to the Special Investigating Unit for further investigation. More now from Khayeletho Magatla, Parliamentary Portfolio Committee Chair on Public Enterprises. Good afternoon to you and welcome. And why then have you made this recommendation?
Yes, it's because of the outcomes of our investigation pertaining to the allegations that were leveled against the minister by the former DG, Director General, Mr. Takudi, that the entities or the companies that were selected for shortlist were four, and among that four, the Takatso Consortium, which happened to win the bid, was not among them. That was one of the allegations that were made. Secondly, that the SAA was undervalued. Also, that the minister picked up the Rand Merchant Bank to be the transactional advisor. And we have to investigate all the validity of those allegations, of which in our process of investigation, it came to our attention that Takatso was not necessarily among the four companies that were shortlisted as per the allegation made by the former DG, and that Takatso came late, and at the beginning, Takatso had an interest in Mango, of which later they changed. But another development was that in the process of Rand Merchant Bank doing its work, they just decided to drop the ball in the process, just left after they were already executed the first part, which is shortlisting. But after they left, the department appointed a team within itself, of which the reason that they appointed the Rand Merchant Bank was because of them not having capacity to do that work. But what surprised the committee is that they continued with the process and even started afresh by having another shortlist, of which that shortlist included Takatso, which was not there previously.
Right. Mr. Chairperson, your committee then has recommended this to the SIU, and you've spoken obviously to the police minister. What criminal activity do you believe has been undertaken in this respect?
We don't have any criminal suspicion so far.
But you've asked this to be discussed or investigated by the SIU.
To answer, You must expect me to answer when you ask a question fully. I'm saying the reason that we could not be able, because the reason that we asked for SIU is a continuation of investigation. We are not saying anyone, but because there are issues that we cannot be able to resolve or answer as a committee. Instead, we have a lot of questions. For example, the one of the questions was that the DG claimed not to have signed any document, while the minister claimed that some of the documents were signed by him that were giving Takatso that particular entity. Now, we saw the signature of the former DG. However, as a committee, we felt that we don't have skills to look at the authenticity of those signatures. Therefore, a much more equipped or people with skills to do that, because it needs some forensic investigation. Therefore, we don't have in forensic capacity as a committee. We felt that another capacitated entity, such as SIU, must look at the matter.
What is the expected outcome of this investigation then?
Well, our role was to just to check whether there is any merit to the DG's allegation, of which for now we still have the DG kind of allegations that have not yet proven wrong by the minister's presentation. Therefore, we want somebody who will be able to dismiss that in a scientific manner, which is that entity such as your SIU.
What do you say to suggestions that the committee is throwing the minister under the bus?
Well, there won't be any value to that kind of allegation. It's just sweeping. Because we have been working with the minister right through on this matter. It was the minister who has not been able to come. Because this thing was supposed to have been finalized as early as May last year. However, we continued with this thing up until this time, 2 months ago. Therefore, we were very patient with the minister, and we've been working with the minister on other issues very progressively and with respect. The members of that committee still respect the minister, and I, as a chairperson, also still have a high regard for the minister. It's such that we won't, because we trust and respect the minister, not do our work, because our work is to play an oversight, and we won't be in a position to undermine those processes because we love the minister, unfortunately.
All right, Mr. Chairperson, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Well, from parliamentary politics to party politics now, and former ANC President Thabo Mbeki is on the campaign trail for the ANC despite his vociferous criticism in the past. Political commentator Dr. Levy Ndawu is with me now. And firstly, are you surprised at this decision, and what specific role do you think he will be playing in the ANC's campaign?
Not surprised at all. Former President Mbeki has made a comeback to the ANC politics and activities for quite some time. You will recall that he has been attending some of the National Executive Committee meetings of late. He actively participated in the policy conference of the ANC just before the elective conference in 2022. And even though he has been quite critical of some of the activities of the ANC, he appears to have availed himself to be part of the solution of the challenges facing the ANC and indeed the country. So my view is that as an active member of the ANC who has been there in different capacities, I'm not surprised that he's actually getting involved in the campaign of the ANC.
What do you think prompted his involvement at this specific time? Is there anything around the timing that is interesting here?
My sense is that looking at his age, there couldn't be any better time than this one. He wouldn't have started with the campaign long time ago, because obviously it would have the potential to take its toll on him. But also at the same time, it couldn't have been that maybe some within the leadership of the ANC were busy trying to persuade him behind closed doors to participate in the campaign. And I think he's also coming at the right time, when we actually left with very few weeks to go towards the elections. And if indeed there are those who might have thought that because former President Mbeki is not actively involved in the activities of the ANC and also not campaigning, they would have had other ideas. But now that he's back, I think this has a potential to boost the campaign of the ANC.
Do you think this will be a popular move across all factions within the party?
I think it could. And I think this move has a potential to clear the air in terms of those who appeared to have thought that former President Mbeki is very extreme when it comes to his relationship with the current leadership of the ANC. And of course, those who wanted him not to be part of the campaign of the ANC could be quite disappointed that now he's back into the campaign of the party. And my sense is that in the spirit of renewal and rebuilding the ANC, leaders such as former President Mbeki and others who have led the party in the past are the ones who should actually be back to be part of this renewal program, because in any way, they are doing it for the ANC and not for any personal benefit.
And they're really doing it for results, though, at the end of the day. So how do you think his involvement could impact voter sentiment? Is his presence likely to reinvigorate the base or attract undecided voters?
My sense is that former President Mbeki has had a very good support from the South African middle class. And my view is that when they actually see former President Mbeki coming back, that has a potential to bring those voters back into the ANC. It has been confirmed by the ANC in the last two elections that some people have actually decided not to participate in the vote, and mainly ANC members who decided to stay at home. And I think now that former President Mbeki is back, this has a potential indeed to bring these voters back into the ANC.
But do you...
Another aspect in my view is that the perception that former President Mbeki is back is that where there are wrong things that he has been raising on a regular basis against the leadership of the ANC, it would appear that the ANC appears to be dealing with such issues that he has raised.
And just a quick one in conclusion, how does his appeal rate with younger voters in this country who may not have a vivid memory of his presidency?
I think it will depend on how he actually interacts with these young people. The fortunate part is that former President Mbeki has a very good history as a person who fought for the liberation of South Africa and as a person who led South Africa as the president of both the party and the ANC. And it is up to the young people themselves to go and re-educate themselves about the role that former President Mbeki has played in the ANC and in government. And of course, a lot of work still has to be done, and mainly by the current leadership of the ANC and their structures, in ensuring that they encourage more people to go out and vote for the ANC.
And I'm going to thank you very much for that analysis. I do appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Patriotic Alliance has beaten both the DA and the ANC in two Western Cape by-elections and came close to unseating the ANC in the town of Clanwilliam. So what is behind this? What do we read into it just ahead of the election, which is now a month away? Joining us now on the program is election pundit Wayne Sussman. And Wayne, what do you make of this then?
Yeah, the Patriotic Alliance, first of all, are one of the, in my opinion, two big unknowns in this election. How far and how high can they go? And they've done a great job at capturing hearts and minds of many voters, particularly in rural areas in the Western Cape. And I think and the DA can go on about it being the best-run province, about winning, about job creation and Auditor General's reports. But if you're a family who haven't got a job or seen that benefit on your table because you're unemployed, then maybe those voters think that the DA's message no longer resonates and they're giving the Patriotic Alliance an opportunity. But also, by the way, there's a big turn away from the ANC. The big losers in this round of by-elections in the Western Cape were the ANC more than the DA. I mean, the DA lost that one ward by 28 votes. Whereas with the ANC, you saw huge drops, and that should worry the ANC greatly in the Western Cape, and of course the DA. I mean, because if the PA can capture hearts and minds in places like Hanover Park, Tafelsig, Mitchell's Plain, Westridge, then that is a nightmare for the DA, and their next 5 years are not guaranteed of leading this province.
When you talk about hearts and minds, Wayne, is it better ideas that are being put on the table by the Patriotic Alliance, or is it just growing disaffection with the Democratic Alliance and just plain anger at the ANC?
I think Gaetan McKenzie is a very talented orator. It's an interesting brand of populism, which is resonating with that particular community, that coloured South Africans are not being well represented, and he is their voice. And he's unashamed and unapologetic of who he is and what the Patriotic Alliance portends to be. And I think that is what's resonating. But again, just one caveat, Jeremy. The PA answered a big question on Wednesday, and that is that they can fight multiple by-elections on a particular day. Can they do this in a national election, which is obviously on a much larger scale? And I mean, if you can do it in three, maybe you can do it nationally. And can they break down that blue wall in the city of Cape Town where 63% of the Western Cape voters are?
So it begs the question then, what kind of counter strategy might the Democratic Alliance use, particularly so close to the May 29 poll?
Yeah, this is a major wake-up call for the DA. And basically what we're going to see now is they're going to have to rally their troops, because it's in George, voters have turned away from the DA to the PA in places like Malmesbury. So the DA is going to have to use all its resources, kind of like what the ANC does on a national level. The DA will have more resources, more volunteers than the PA, and it's going to have to deploy these and convince people that it's a much better bet for them to remain with the DA. So far, all attacks on Gaetan McKenzie haven't been successful, i.e. that he's corrupt, i.e. it's the doomsday coalition, I think that's what they call it, with the ANC and the EFF. That messaging hasn't been successful. So they're going to have to really go back to the drawing board and think about their messaging and think about how to appeal to the sector of the Western Cape population, which is becoming increasingly enamored with Gaetan McKenzie.
The last thing any political party wants to do with a month to go before an election, though, is to start recalibrating or even changing its messaging.
Yeah, so this is where I give credit to the ANC and the DA. They've done these rodeos before. There's something in elections called the squeeze, which the ANC are the masters at, where opinion polls show the ANC down in the doldrums and opposition parties surging. But when you unveil people like Thabo Mbeki or Mama Joy, who Chauke, South Africa's number one sports fan who goes to all the events, and you start deploying your NEC to every nook and cranny of the country, that starts paying dividends in the last 30 days. And I'd say that the same will go for the DA, that it has more public representatives. It's done this rodeo before of getting people to the polls, knowing where their voters are, knowing who's likely to vote for them. If it doesn't work this time, it's a nightmare scenario for the DA.
I'm going to leave it there. Wayne Sussman, thank you very much indeed for that analysis.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, we've had three big political stories now. Now I want to pivot to the economy, and my next guest says this year's budget speech missed an opportunity to leverage the role of small, medium, and micro enterprises as a catalyst to achieve much-needed economic growth, job creation, and increased tax revenues. I want to talk now to Mapefo Sepula, who is a development economist. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. So could you elaborate firstly on what specific measures or supports you'd hoped to see included that weren't mentioned?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Jeremy, and good afternoon to your listeners. Yeah, I definitely think from our perspective as an organization, Property Point, that works with entrepreneurs and really recognizing their role in the economy, I think what we would have wanted to see more of is really just looking in terms of the budget speech and allocation towards critical policies. I know we've heard a lot of in terms of some of the initiatives, whether it be the National Small Enterprise Amendment Bill or the Integrated Small Enterprise Development Master Plan. So really just seeing more kind of funding to ensuring the effective implementation of these policies, but also kind of addressing some of the challenges, particularly when we kind of look at red tape and the significant impact that has on small businesses. So I think oftentimes we hear a lot of conversations around the various challenges that we are facing as a country, but often such as load shedding, but oftentimes then small businesses are not incorporated into the conversation in terms of how do you help them navigate in this current economic climate.
Do you think, therefore, that government is missing a trick, missing a beat in its understanding and the prioritization of the role of small businesses in driving economic growth?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of mention, you know, when you kind of listen around the importance of small businesses. But I don't think when it comes to the active implementation of key policies in terms of addressing these challenges and ensuring that small businesses are part of the conversation when we're crafting these policies to drive economic growth. So I think it's really just a critical being able to hear and understand what small businesses are facing and how these various economic challenges are impacting small businesses and how they also are part of the solution and how they can drive economic growth and job creation. Because I think from the small business perspective, I think a lot of innovative ideas in terms of how we solve some of our challenges could come.
Yet government will turn around and they say they have the National Small Enterprise Amendment Bill. Does that not go far enough?
I think, yeah, we would definitely agree that, you know, the Small Enterprise Amendment Bill is in the right direction in terms of being able to ensure you're creating an enabling environment for small businesses, access to finance, access to markets. But I think, you know, it needs to be a holistic approach and kind of looking across all departments and ensuring that the conversation around SME development is tackled across the different departments and not just through one department and one policy measure. And I think what we also do know, there's a lot of kind of great policies, but I think it's around the implementation and ensuring there's adequate funding to drive the implementation of those policies.
Well, I think you've just preempted my next question. Access to markets is absolutely critical, but it's also access to funding. And you'll agree that financial institutions often favor larger corporations. Is there a better way of designing a more optimum funding mechanism that would better support these small enterprises?
Yeah, I think we really do need to look at our funding mechanisms. And I think also when we kind of look at how, you know, they assess credit score and as well as measure risks, I think is also kind of looking at how when we are funding small businesses, how we are assessing their funding applications. So I think really just re-looking back, because I think we're still utilizing very traditional mechanisms to assess whether we can provide funding to small businesses. So I think really looking into that, and I think also just looking in terms of alternative funding for small businesses to kind of support.
But in that respect, the small enterprises themselves, I would imagine, need to work harder and smarter, not only in accessing the funding, but also marketing and perhaps being a little bit more focused in the work that they're doing.
And I think that's where also incubation programs come in as well, in terms of ensuring that they're able to support entrepreneurs through this journey. I think it's also really around access to information, in terms of how to better position themselves within the market and be competitive within the market. And that's where the kind of the role of incubation programs such as ourselves, Property Point, where you're able to support entrepreneurs when it comes to elements like that as well.
I'm going to leave it there. Mapefu Sipola, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time on this Friday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And I want to finish with this afternoon. Demand for private student accommodation, I'm told, is booming in recent years. But this isn't the only student-focused property type that is seeing a resurgence. An increasing number of matriculants are opting to enroll in privately funded colleges to continue their studies. What does that mean? Well, it would require these higher education institutions to expand or relocate their physical premises to accommodate this increased demand. Let me try and pull all of that together. Don Jack Galletti is with me, Chief Executive Officer of Galletti Corporate Real Estate. Thank you very much for joining us. The current boom in demand for private student accommodation, what does it say firstly about changing preferences when it comes to students and what they're actually looking for?
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, really, it's an increased demand level overall. We're finding that the traditional universities just can't accommodate all the people coming through the system. So as people are progressing, now they're looking for opportunities, and as we see, what people want to study and what they want to learn is changing.
So it's difficult to find, I would imagine, or to establish something which is of quality, is safe, and is affordable. To hit those three measures is difficult, surely.
And as you start hitting those three measures, the rentals go up. And of course, students do want to be around all of these amenities. They do want to be safe. They want to be close to restaurants and, you know, places where they can walk around. And it has a cool factor, if I could put it that way. But you're 100% correct. That's an in-demand item, and the rentals are at top of the market.
So are we keeping pace with that demand, do you think?
I think that there are always opportunities, but what needs to happen in these situations is that, of course, you need to take the whole building. As you can imagine, students tend to hang around the building and use it a different way from a corporate tenant. So you've got to find one building which suits the entire operation, and that's where the challenge is.
How do you get this right without entering into the exploitation of students when it comes to accommodation, either by offering them something which is inferior or something that is too expensive? And you'll well know, John, that these allegations have been made in the past. It's a fine line to tread, I imagine.
Yes. You know, and of course, the differentiation between the actual building that the university or operation occupies, that's one thing. And on the other side, it's the actual accommodation for the students, being their sort of housing or how they get in. And what you typically find is that they're going into bigger sort of res situations where they have smaller rooms and they have shared facilities, and that actually brings down the cost considerably.
On the flip side of this conversation is the design and the location of new campuses, I imagine. And what kind of consideration is now being given into choosing new campus location? And as you've rightly mentioned, close to industry hubs, but also to urban centres, that cool factor that you mentioned.
Exactly. And you've got to cross-reference it. You look at Eris, for example, building, I think it's up to 900 student accommodations right near the city or down near the station in Cape Town, taking Cape Town as an example. And then, of course, you've got the institutions putting themselves around the Waterkant and these areas. So it's not such a far stretch between the two. What the accommodation's doing is they're looking for a good zone close to the student facilities, but also in a better priced part of town. And then you're actually finding the university placing themselves in a higher part of town, because that's where you spend most of your day. You're going to be spending your day around the restaurants, and you want to be able to you know, almost hang out, as it were, in between the classes. I can remember some of the first guys being Varsity College when they came out of their private institution. They were still working it out at that stage. And I think it's progressed since then. We're some 25 years down the track.
So I guess the final question then is probably the most important one, is that the expansion or relocation of private colleges and the need for that accommodation, what impact is it having on the real estate market itself?
Well, what you're finding is, and luckily they use office space, basically. So they use office space, and office space has been depressed over the last couple of years. And so these spaces are available, and they're taking the opportunity to find them and take up that space right now. But as they take up that space, especially in Cape Town, again, using it as an example, you're finding that that space is becoming more and more limited, and you're starting to see those rentals start to climb again as there's new demand for these office spaces where they haven't been converted to residential. They're actually getting converted to student campuses now, and you're finding less and less vacancy. And as there's less vacancy, more demand, we know what happens.
Thank you very much for joining me. And I'm going to finish today with our online poll. Just let me reference yesterday, I asked you about voter-written manifestos to hold politicians to account. And well over half our respondents saying that political manifestos are a waste of time and are hardly ever read. Today, we'll continue to focus on politics. And we reported earlier that former ANC president and the country's president, Thabo Mbeki, back on the ANC campaign trail. And my question today is it going to make a difference? Is this a waste of time? Or, as far as the ANC is concerned, is this possibly a sign of desperation? If you'd like to participate in that poll, I'll invite you to go to MoneyWeb, our Twitter page, or our LinkedIn page. Cast your vote, and I'll bring you the results on Monday. That's where we are going to leave it. MoneyWeb at midday. We're live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Have a good weekend, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.